Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Tim Stoner is the Managing Director of Space Syntax, a firm of architects and planners that are specialists in the scientific analysis of pedestrian behaviour. Their work looks at movement at every scale of the city, forecasting where people will walk, cycle, drive, or be driven, should there be a change in the street pattern or built environment be altered. They have had a hand in the redevelopment of public realm in many traditional cities, not least in London's prime public squares, but they've also developed forecasting techniques to predict movement patterns in future cities. Our discussion ranges widely, considering how we get around now and how digital technologies will alter the way we will navigate the cities of the future. The interview was recorded in St Andrew's Gardens in Bloomsbury, just a short walk from Space Syntax's offices, in June 2013.
I'm an architect and town planner, and I'm the managing director of Space Syntax, which provides consulting advice on the design and planning of towns and cities, and takes a particularly scientific approach to the design of walking systems and, in fact, the design of movement in its entirety. So that means cycling, driving, and moving at every scale in the city.
And so what you're telling me straight away is that we humans are creatures of habit and very predictable in what our behaviours are. Is that right?
To a degree we are. We're a species that follows patterns. And those patterns are, to a degree, forecastable. I couldn't say we can determine the movement of individuals, but we can forecast the patterns of most people most of the time. And that allows us to be sufficiently robust in our forecasts as to say this particular route will be busier than that particular route for reasons which come down to the way that those routes create a network.
What was going on before you chaps turned up? Did people plan for pedestrians and cyclists, or was it just planning for cars? How was it?
That's a good question. I see it in two simple phases. Before the 20th century and after the 20th century. Before the 20th century, or let's call it the Industrial Revolution, towns and cities grew relatively incrementally. They evolved. And so decisions were made at a relatively small scale and over a relatively long period of time. And when mistakes were made, they were corrected quite simply. So when things were put in the wrong place, people realized this and changed. You know, if you put the shop in the back street and it didn't trade, you moved it to the front street. After the 20th century, or as the Industrial Revolution led to the rapid growth of cities, we got town planning and we got mega projects happening very quickly. And at that point, they were quite literally concreted into place. And so it was then very difficult to go back and change anything which went wrong. The problem was exacerbated because the way that we thought about cities changed as well. And we stopped building what you might call traditional streets, houses and buildings facing the street with somewhere for you to walk and somewhere for you to drive. Instead, we created housing estates, or we created new towns that were filled with parks, landscapes, more green than we had ever seen in cities before. And unfortunately, all of this well-intended planning and design often went wrong. Look at the problem of inner-city housing estates in the UK and throughout the world. Look at the problem of new towns in the UK not performing economically, not creating the jobs, not creating the property values that they were intended to. It was all well-intended, but a lot of it went badly wrong. And so what we're trying to do about all of this is to bring some rigour in the first instance, but also some deep human analysis of what people actually do to bear on the planning and design process so that we don't make these mistakes again.
How long has the Space Syntax, well, not only the entity of the business, but, you know, prior to it, the research, etc.?
The Space Syntax Research Programme has been going for 40 years, in fact over 40 years. It was started by Professor Bill Hillier at University College London in the 1970s from an interest in why housing estates in particular were going bad, why people were moving out of them. It led to the important discovery of the role of space and spatial connections and linkage and connectivity that then became, as it was more closely analysed, more mathematical. And then the computer arrived, and through the 1980s it was computerised, the analysis of linkage and networks and systems of connections. During the 1980s it was picked up as a technique by community groups who were opposing large urban planning projects in central London that they felt were going to disconnect them from their local areas, that were going to stop them walking and moving freely around, and they felt were going to threaten the way of life that they got used to. It was successfully used in planning appeals to the point where business got interested to say, well, look, we don't want to meet you at the next planning appeal. Could you actually work on our behalf? And that was the origins of the consultancy. And a company was created in the late 1980s, which I now run, Space Syntax Limited, on the back of the Space Syntax Research Programme at UCL. And I've been running that since 1995. So the company is heading into its 25th year now. We'll celebrate our 25th anniversary as a business in July next year. What we've done throughout this time is to make sure that the academic origins of Space Syntax are developed alongside the commercial applications. So the research and the practice go hand in hand, and that we never divorce the two. You know, a lot of universities create spin-off companies that leave the university and go off and make money, and they never see the university from which they came from again. We've actually learned that the process works best for us when we've stayed in orbit around the university and brought the experience of practice back into the university to say, this is what we've learned, these are the questions our clients are asking us, these are the problems we're coming across that we haven't seen before. These are often problems which need very rapid responses, and it fires the academics up to think cleverer thoughts faster, and they love the interaction with practice. But there's an important separation so that they have the time and space to do their business properly of fundamental research and teaching, and then we have an environment where we can do our practice in a concentrated and professional way.
If you're reproducing or recreating new cities, like for example in the Far East, you're just templating the same old stuff, aren't you? It's almost the excitement or the challenge is to sort of build a new extension onto an older city.
You're absolutely right about that last point. That okay. is the challenge. It's not about templating. Essentially, what we're doing at Space Syntax is, in the first instance, observing how human beings behave in space. That means how they move, but also where they stop to sit, where they choose to converse, how that happens in public space as well as in buildings, how that has a social component, which is important for social sustainability, how it has a cultural dimension, so that the way we might do it here in London is different to the way it might be done in China or Jeddah or Brisbane. And it also has an important economic dimension, because footfall, the movement of people through places, creates opportunities for trade. And that's essentially what cities are for. Cities are intensifications of opportunities to trade. That's my definition of the city. It's why we have them. It's so that we got a better chance of meeting somebody else who we can do business with. And that trade is simultaneously social and economic. It's forming relationships.
I was going to say,
as well as trading goods.
No romance in your world. Well, no, there is.
It's all about romance. Oh, no, quite wrong. Okay. The city's a phenomenal object of human interaction,
yeah.
And the benefits flow socially through relationships as much as they do economically through trade. And I think for all of those reasons, people are drawn to cities. Cities are therefore incredibly, and towns and villages are incredible intensifications of these wonderful moments. So I'd like to think it's deeply romantic. And if we're using science, it's not to sanitize the process, but to understand it and say, well, how exactly does a city work? You notice the importance of these channels of movement, these streets, these pathways. And what we're bringing to this discussion is the discovery that you can measure the strength of a linkage and the likelihood that it will carry movement, so that when you come to plan future cities, you've got a better chance of putting the connections together to form the street network, and then the attractions in the right place, so that the shops that need movement are where their connections are strongest, and the houses and parks where you want some repose are given their correct place in the network as well. And that you're never too far from a busy street, and you're never too far from a quiet space. And in fact, the place we're in right now is evidence of the way that when cities get it right, they get it right wonderfully well, that in 30 seconds we could be on a very busy street. But right now, we're in a relatively quiet, you know, three men, a woman and a dog kind of environment. And that's exactly what you need in the city, to give you the right balance between busy and quiet. And so when it comes to clients, we're asked by all different sorts of people. Every day there's a new kind of inquiry, often from a new kind of group, whether it's still a community group with a concern about a development, whether it's a voracious property developer who wants to, you know, turn as much money from a development as possible, to whom we'll say, you know, it's not just about a quick win. It's not just about get in, build, sell, get out. It's about a long-term return. If you really want to make money, take a long-term attitude towards development. Or it might be a police force that wants to understand how vulnerability exists.
I'm going to say many of the streets of London were created to control the rabble, weren't they?
Well, I don't
they
know.
They were planned to be straight.
I think you can look at cities that way, and you can talk about Paris, for example, in exactly the same way. That the corridors, the boulevards of Paris facilitate the movement of troops, and I'm sure they do. But what they also do is facilitate movement per se, and that has a simultaneous economic benefit and a cultural benefit, that the boulevards of Paris, the streets of London, are wonderfully evocative of all, for all sorts of reasons. It's then sometimes the case that there are streets and pathways that really have very little cultural benefit but a lot of social threat. And I'm thinking in particular of many routes through many social housing estates, public housing estates built post-war, where they're essentially labyrinthine in their layout, and people find it very hard to navigate them. That is not just because many of them are concrete or brick or high-rise or podium or any of these badges that are often given to modernist housing, but we found it's especially because the routing is dislocated, the lines of sight are shorter, the twists and turns are greater. My colleagues, the cognitive scientists, tell me it's because the brain is wired to prefer relative simplicity. The brain likes grid-like structures, which is typically the historic pattern of cities. They're grids. The building blocks of cities generally have four sides.
I thought that was something that came with a car. To turn that corner, it had to get round a square block.
If you look at the earliest cities, they are grids. And I'm spending an increasing amount of time in China, and I'm learning about the history of Chinese cities. And they are as rectilinear a grid as you'll find in North America, or you'll find in many often settled grids of Latin America, Australia. The grid is not just a modern phenomenon of the car, it's a consistent historic creation. I think it's a natural shape, actually.
So perhaps for the car, the difference is that we've made the sides of the rectangle longer.
It makes cycling longer, it makes walking longer. This is very typically a problem found in either modern cities or modernized cities. So we're working in the city of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, at the moment, where, you know, if you think about the climate of Saudi Arabia, you might think, well, who wants to walk there? In fact, many people do. And it's a normal mode of transport when it's possible. People walk later in the day, they walk when it's darker, or they walk on the shaded streets that catch the breeze. There's a wonderful breeze comes over the Red Sea from Africa and irrigates those streets in Jeddah that are fortunate enough to align with it. What's happened since Jeddah originally evolved hundreds of years ago is that these car-based streets have been created. And they've been created especially in the last 30 years with these long building frontages that you've just described, without basic infrastructure for pedestrians. Forget cyclists, you know, that's not even been thought about. The buildings themselves have turned their backs on the main streets, and then the main streets have become motorways, and then the pedestrians are forced into subways or onto bridges. You can see in the history of a single street the evolution from pedestrian focus to car focus in less than a generation. And this is not just happening in Saudi Arabia, it's happening in China.
Once the concrete's poured and set, it's quite difficult to take it all down and start again, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, that was the point made by the mayor of one of the cities that we're working in. And he said that he had a choice. He could see the choice between motorway-based streets, which involve digging and pouring, or traditional tree-lined avenues, which would still require maintenance, but of a quite different nature. And he said it's a simple choice. It's a financial choice. Lots of us might say, well, it's a design choice, it's a lifestyle choice, it's a cultural choice. And I'm sure those issues were important as well, but the principal reason influencing his decision was financial. Because once you pour that stuff, it's, as you say, incredibly expensive to do anything about it.
Are you more passionate about building the extension to the existing city, or maybe making the existing city more navigable or easier to get around? Or is it the new stuff that you're interested in?
I think if there's a choice, it's fixing old cities that have been damaged recently by car-based development and restoring. You know, I love restoring cities to their future. If you can mix those sort of temporal senses, restoring something to its future, which means taking something that it might have had in its past, bringing that back, which would be the human focus, the pedestrian focus.
Give us an example of something that your firm has been involved in.
One is Trafalgar Square. Trafalgar Square was a traffic roundabout. In the 1990s, we were asked to take part in the competition to redesign it, and we worked with Norman Foster. Trafalgar Square today looks entirely different. One arm of the roundabout has been pedestrianised in front of the National Gallery. A new staircase has been opened to allow people to flow more easily from the edge of the square to the centre. Quite different to what it was, where 99% of Londoners walked around the outside of Trafalgar Square, because it was just too complicated to walk through the middle. And today the square works fantastically well. I took some friends visiting from China to see Trafalgar Square the other day, and we couldn't get in. It was too busy, full of life. Now, Trafalgar Square hasn't been restored to its history. It was a parade ground, it was all sorts of things, but it's been restored to the human dimension that it would have had before the imposition of fast-moving vehicles. And so that's one place which is a great example of human-focused design.
Can you think about the suburban London and that sort of area, and how people get around there now, how we can encourage them to get around more on foot or by bike and link in with public transport, and then sort of, dare I put you on the spot and say, how are we going to get around there in 20 or 30 years' time?
Well, I live in a relatively small town outside of London. I think wherever you are, you know, whether you're central, suburban, whether you're in a town or a village, the area around you will be full of opportunities for improvement. It may just be a missing pedestrian crossing. It may be that the green pedestrian phase on those traffic lights that are there is just too short. It may be that there's a little walkway that could be opened up for the sake of putting a gate in a fence, if you could get the permission to do that. People could get together and agree that actually the public access that would create would probably help some of the economic activities that are there and struggling at the moment for lack of footfall, then you can do this. I think also cycling is important, that as a mode of transport, cycling provides the ability, especially in less dense urban settings like the edges, the suburbs of places, to travel distances at convenience. Yet at the moment, cycle infrastructure provision is not great. It's not just about painting lines on streets or creating cycle paths. It's also about driver awareness and the culture of behaviour. It's also about cycling culture, and pedestrians. We have to learn to live with each other as modes of movement and acknowledge that we're a cyclist on Saturday and a train commuter on Monday and a pedestrian every day and a driver occasionally, you know, if I just take myself as an example. And I have to change my behaviour to understand which mode I'm in at which time and which other modes I need to accommodate around me. We're getting better at this. I mean, cycling in London generally has improved significantly in recent years. That is going to force itself on us. We'll have to accommodate that change anyway. In my job as a planner and as a thinker about the future, I'd rather we start having those thoughts now than wait for them to be imposed upon us. At whatever budget level we've got, the place to start is by observing the way places are to begin with, one, and two, engaging with people locally to help you do that and pool the collective experiences of, yes, the professional coming from out of town can be helpful, parachuting in and giving an external perspective, but really helpful if it's engaged with a local perspective.
Both you and I are iPhone users, so we're probably inundated with apps that we... some of which we know how to use and some of them we don't. What's going to happen in the future? Is everyone going to be looking on their iPhone and not talking to everybody, bumping into each other because they're looking at their iPhone and not looking where they're going? How are we going to get around? What's going to happen online and offline?
I think it's pretty exciting. There's another line of argument, which is we won't need to move at all because we'll have everything we need where we are. And to go back to where we started, that there's a fundamental property of cities is that they bring people together to transact, and I don't think that will ever go away. I think the innate human desire to be in the company of other human beings will always mean we'll move. We won't just reside in our rural retreats with a plasma screen and a Skype connection. But the way we move, I think, will change, and I'm a fatal optimist, I think, for the better. There's a lot of bad information, there's a lot of poor information about cities at the moment. The opportunity of apps and the opportunity of websites and digital and so on is to make that information more freely available. I work with an organization called the Academy of Urbanism, and we've created a concept for a website called Know Your Place, which is more than a Google map. It's more than one of those house finder when you're buying or selling a house and you find out what the property values are near you, or it's more than one of those thermal imaging maps that tells you whether your roof is losing more or less heat. Those things are all helpful, but they're all in different places. If digital technology can pull all of this information together and give us information about, you know, how good the local schools are, but also what happened here in history, where you can buy a pint of milk and whether this is a good place to go on holiday, all in the same place as opposed to on dispersed websites, that's an area where I think there's still a lot of work for digital to do to help us know our places. That's why this Know Your Place project is something I'm quite excited about. I'd like to see that move forwards.
Much of the work you do, it must be commercially discreet, but is there a way in which people can look at and see some of the work that Space Syntax has done?
Yes, our website, spacesyntax.com, is where the commercial projects are presented. We're a great believer in openness. Giving things away is actually part of the networking that cities teach us to do. You give to get.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Tim Stoner. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited. Our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.